Hi, everybody. Welcome. Welcome, everyone. Let's make sure our microphone's working. Is this working? Excellent. Well, welcome, everyone. It is great to be with you. I am Congressman Jared Huffman. I am the reason we've got a slightly late start today, and I apologize for that. I was in San Francisco introducing a dear friend of mine who happens to be running for president. It turns out in this presidential cycle, Mike Thompson and I have a ton of friends running for president. So they are keeping us busy, but it's really great to be with all of you here at Dominican University and to be with all of our terrific participants. This, of course, is a very important conversation we're having about gun violence. It's also timely. Obviously, in light of the tragedy in San Diego County yesterday, which is on all of our minds. But in a sense, this issue and this conversation would be timely any day of any year, because our gun violence epidemic has just become that bad. So thank you for joining us to take part in a very important community dialogue with some real leaders on this issue. I want to especially thank Penguin Radio for broadcasting today's summit, Pat Johnstone for organizing volunteers to circulate voter registration materials. That's an important piece of citizenship to connect with this issue, for sure. And I want to thank my great friend and colleague, Congressman Mike Thompson. I'm going to say a little more about Mike in a moment and invite him to share some thoughts with you. But right now, I want to tell you a little bit about the program. So some of you may have been with us last year when we had our student summit. And like that summit, this is meant to be primarily a student-driven conversation. We have 10 schools represented here today. And we have four organizations as well. All of them are doing amazing, wonderful work to promote public safety. So we're going to have a very lively conversation, and there are also some nonprofits in the audience today that are doing great work on this front too. I want to shout out to Beyond Differences, which is working to end social isolation, and also a newly formed group, Men Against Gun Violence, which is helping to elevate the conversation. We're going to kick off today's program by allowing the folks on stage to introduce themselves, and then we'll get right into a group dialogue. I will be facilitating the conversation along with Congressman Thompson, and my staff will be collecting questions from you. So this is how you participate in this dialogue. Raise your hand if you'd like to get a card, and we will be collecting on these two aisles, we'll be collecting your cards and feeding those questions into the conversation as we go forward. All right. Well, it is now my great pleasure to introduce someone that I am honored to share part of my district with. Congressman Mike Thompson represents about half of Sonoma County. I've got the other half. I could not ask for a better neighbor or a better mentor. Congressman Thompson has been doing this work since he got to Washington in 1998, but he has been a public servant for a lot longer than that. He was a longtime California state senator, actually chaired the budget committee in the state Senate. In Congress, he serves on the powerful Ways and Means Committee, and now that we have a Democratic majority, he gets to hold a gavel in his hand. And he's the chairman of the Select Revenue Measures Subcommittee. But what he's really known for, especially for the last several years, is his leadership on this issue of gun violence. In the wake of the Newtown, Connecticut mass shooting, and I remember this vividly because I was just getting ready to come to Congress. I was in Boston taking part in a new member training seminar because I had just been elected to Congress. And in the wake of that tragedy, Mike Thompson was named chair of the House Gun Violence Prevention Task Force. And what a perfect selection by Nancy Pelosi. Mike Thompson knows a thing or two about guns. He knows about them from serving our country in the military during the Vietnam War. He knows about them as a hunter and a sportsman. He owns way more guns than just about anybody I know. And he is passionate about gun safety. So he's been working away for the last several years, and the culmination of a lot of that work happened just a few weeks ago. You talk about a difference that an election can make. For the first time in a decade, we were allowed to have a vote on the floor of the House of Representatives on the gun violence issue, and Mike Thompson's bill, H.R. 8, for universal background checks, passed out of the House with bipartisan support. There is no more passionate or effective leader on this issue in the United States Congress than my friend Mike Thompson, and I'd like to invite him to say a few words of welcome to you now.
Well, thank you very much. Jared, thank you for a very, very kind introduction. It's an honor for me to be here with all of you, and an honor for me to be here with my friend and my legislative partner, Jared Huffman. He told you that we shared part of the district. We split Sonoma County, but as important, my old district is represented by Jared Huffman. My district used to go from Yolo County over to Napa to Sonoma and all the way up to the Oregon border. And in the last redistricting, our districts all changed. And now Del Norte, Humboldt, Mendocino, and the part of Sonoma County that I used to represent is represented by Jarrett, and I can't think of a better person to do that. He does a fantastic job up there and here in Marin County. So, Jared, thank you. He neglected to tell you that when the Democrats won the House, he too now has a gavel in the Natural Resources Committee, and I don't think there's anyone who knows more about natural resources and the laws that protect our natural resources than Jarrett, and he's doing a fine job there, so thank you. Well, as Jarrett mentioned, after the tragedy at Sandy Hook, I was named the chair of the task force, and I wasn't at a new member orientation. To be quite blunt, I was in the Sacramento bypass duck hunting that day. And I got the information over my then means of communication, my BlackBerry, and I was as heartbroken as anyone. It was that afternoon on the way back that I had a telephone conversation with then leader Nancy Pelosi, who called to tell me that she had just received a haircut from one of our colleagues, telling her that guns are the third rail in politics. Don't touch them, we'll all be electrocuted, leave it alone. Guns are beautiful things, we don't need any laws, we just let it go. And she then told me, she says, you know, I said, isn't there anything we can do? Can we deal with the clip capacity? To which the response was, you don't know the difference between a clip and a magazine. You don't have any business dealing with guns. Just leave them alone. And my response was, I may not know more than this guy, but he doesn't know any more than I do about guns. And I think we should talk about this issue. I think there is something that we can do, and I'd be happy to help you do it. The next day, and 2 days later, I show up in Washington. We have a caucus meeting. So we heard from your classmate, Elizabeth Esty, who represented Sandy Hook, hadn't yet been sworn into office, and she was in a fire station in Newtown with parents who were waiting to find out if it was their toddler who was dead or they were going to bring their toddler home. And Nancy announced that she was going to put together a task force and that I was going to chair it. So for 6.5 years, I chaired that task force. I brought together every imaginable interest on the issue of guns, from people who don't think there should be any to people who don't think there should be any regulations pertaining to guns. We heard from the NRA, we heard from the Brady folks, we heard from the police chiefs, the sheriffs, everybody. And we put together a very comprehensive list of legislative proposals that would in fact do something about gun violence. The number one issue, the number one proposal on that list agreed to by everyone was to expand background checks. So I wrote that bill that first year. It would have expanded background checks. For 6.5 years, we did not have one single hearing on that bill. For 6.5 years, we did not have one single vote on that bill. I was so discouraged that I put in another bill that called for the creation of a select committee, half Democrats, half Republicans. I said, if you don't like our ideas, let's sit down, let's hear yours, let's figure out what we can do to move ahead to deal with this. Not one hearing, not one vote. Moment of silence after moment of silence after moment of silence after moment of silence. Because as you know, mass shootings seem to be a daily occurrence. We have 30 people every day who are killed by someone using a gun. If you add suicides and accidental shootings to that number, it jumps up to about 100. It cost us as taxpayers about $230 billion a year. Those are impressive numbers. Think about that. 30 people every day killed by someone using a gun. Another 90-some suicides and accidental shootings. $230 billion. 6.5 years without a hearing or a vote. Another number that's very important, 218. That's the number of votes it takes to elect a new speaker. It's the number of votes it takes to pass a bill out of the House of Representatives. And because of the last election, we had a sea change in the House. We elected a new speaker with more than 218 votes, and immediately I was allowed to introduce my bill, H.R. 8. Immediately it was set for a hearing in the Judiciary Committee, was passed, brought to the floor, and passed again. The first time in 26 years that a serious gun violence prevention bill passed the House of Representatives. So we're working hard on this issue. Your interest and your being here today shows us that we're right. I talk to people every day. 60% of high school students feel threatened by gun violence. That's wrong. We send our kids to school to learn, not to be afraid. And we as a people need to come together and address this issue. And with your help, I'm sure that we'll do our job and we'll make significant steps forward in regard to gun violence prevention. So thank you, and Jared, thanks for letting me be here.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mike. So we're going to now go to our panelists, but before we do that, I have a quick question for our audience. Raise your hand if either you or someone you know, a friend or a family member, has been a victim of gun violence. That's a pretty significant number, and I know my hand goes up on that as well. That's a big part of why we are going to prevail on this issue, folks. The grim reality is that the constituency for gun violence reform is growing all the time as people's lives are touched by this issue. So you should feel hopeful may not be the right word in light of how grim the subject is, but we are winning. So let's go to the folks who are some of our great leaders in the advocacy world. I'll ask them to introduce themselves and their organization. And then we're going to keep moving kind of quickly to our student ambassadors.
Hi, my name is Helen Rosen. I'm the chapter leader for the Marin chapter of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense. And first I want to say I'm honored that our organization is invited here by Congressman Huffman and Congressman Thompson. We're thrilled to be part of this extremely important discussion and the second discussion year annual town hall we've had on this. In Moms Demand Action, we're a nonpartisan group, and we work to campaign for common sense gun laws to help prevent gun violence in this country and to keep families safe. We're thrilled that H.R. 8 passed, expanded background checks. You may not know, but 97% of people in this country advocate for expanded background checks. That means 97% of both parties, and of gun owners and non-gun owners, want expanded background checks. I became involved with this organization about 5 years ago. I was sick and tired of watching mass shootings on TV and crying. And I decided that I had to find a way to take some action to do something. And I'm so thrilled to be part of this wonderful organization that takes a lot of action and has made a difference. We campaigned this year, and we made a difference in the House that we now have a gun sense majority of candidates in the House of Representatives. And we had the first discussion, as Congressman Thompson was saying, on gun prevention. We also do work in California. One of the things that we do every year is we go to the California legislature, and we have a goal each year. This year, we're working to encourage Governor Newsom to put $39 million in his budget for the California Violence Intervention Program. That program provides grants to community organization and cities where gun violence is the highest to help them have programs that encourage gun prevention efforts. I also want to let you know that we have a very active chapter here in Marin. We meet once a month on the first Friday of the month. And our next big event is our annual Wear Orange walk across the Golden Gate Bridge, which is a walk again to help to raise awareness for gun prevention, gun violence prevention, and we hope that you will join us on that walk. So thank you very much, and
thanks, Helen.
I'm gonna pass this on to you.
Hi, my name is Dana Spaeth Williams, and I am a mother of three, and a photographer and a painter. I got involved with this issue about 5 years ago. I was gutted by Sandy Hook, just like everyone else, and I decided to add my voice to the cause. So I created a video featuring children delivering a plea for safety from gun violence. The video was picked up by MSN, AOL, Yahoo, went around the world, and I was targeted and trolled by gun extremists. I received thousands and thousands and thousands of messages and comments saying things like, I hope ISIS comes and rapes you and your children. Sandy Hook never happened, nobody died. So I became involved with Moms Demand Action, and I am currently the public awareness and education presentations lead. I deliver presentations across Marin. Oftentimes, I invite my daughter, Isabel, who is the leader of TAM High's Students Demand Action chapter. I invite her to come along with me, because when a young adult says, describes what it's like to live in fear of mass shootings, describes what it's like to have a teacher say, if a mass shooter comes to the door, just throw your desk at them, describes what it's like to be largely ignored by politicians, when a young adult describes these things, people listen. I believe that young people have been pivotal in changing this issue, and I believe that fundamentally they are going to lead us into meaningful change. So I am thrilled to be here, and I want to applaud these children for leading us.
Thank you, Dana.
Hi, I'm Tony Porter. I'm a San Rafael resident. I'm also on the board of trustees for the Brady Organizations, headquartered in DC. But operating nationally across the country. And as I was sitting here, I was sort of interesting how this panel sort of reflects how gun violence is now actually moving and changing and actually producing results. We have a few legislatures, a lot of women, and some great kids. And that's been the difference in the last probably year or two, and as to why we're seeing incredible activity around this important issue. I came to this issue and the Brady Organization in the same way many people following Sandy Hook. I have two children, and it would affect anybody with or without children, but that was a heart-shredding moment. But what really was dispiriting is the complete inaction from our leaders, not through lack of effort by some, but the complete inaction of our society to actually do something positive and proactive in a public policy sensible way. And then I thought, well, what kind of world am I leaving my kids if that's true? A dysfunctioning democracy, and then we layer into that or put into that a horrific problem that is potentially solvable, but we're not. So am I handing my kids a life of being nasty, brutish, and short? Is it everybody's packing heat? Every argument can be a terminal argument. Do we want to function in a way that Somalia and Afghanistan function? You know, how are we ever going to have positive race relations? Do police relations remain poisonous? Can we ever develop our inner city when we're weaponized? And I was just checking the box, no, 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 no. So I got off my moral fence that I'd been sitting on for a long time about guns and started writing checks. I wrote my checks to the Brady Organization because they were the only organization to have actually affected federal legislation. Finally, President Clinton signed it after Jim and Sarah Brady proselytized background checks for 6 or 7 years prior to that. So we now have the Brady background check bill. And the reason H.R. 8 is so important is because we've had developments like the internet and markets where guns can easily be sold. So the idea of universality is critically important, and I applaud that congressmen's work on that. The other part of what Brady does are public safety, so PSA type things. We recently introduced a campaign called End Family Fire. And Family Fire is the idea that people are shooting themselves in their own home, thinking they brought in a protective device. It turns out to be a device causing harm in the home. We also have other programs like Ask and a crime gun program where we look to identify the disproportionate number of crime guns and who sold them. Go to that seller, ask them to reform, or sue them out of business. And the other part of our activities are around litigation. You can think of it as enforcement. We try to shame people who should be doing their jobs. If we can't, we'll actually litigate them. So we've recouped millions of dollars for victims of gun violence, and we've also done things recently. We've sued the ATF for the records they're unwilling to put into the public domain. And we're learning enormous things about how we actually enforce our gun laws in the country. So look for more in that area from us. But it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you all.
Good afternoon. My name is Kara Connors. I'm a public health professional. I am the community outreach and education coordinator for Bucklew programs here in San Rafael. Bucklew is the largest behavioral health center here in Northern California. We provide housing, counseling, employment services. And in addition, we run the 24/7 free confidential suicide prevention hotline. We receive about 14,000 calls a year. We're starting to see greater numbers of children calling us. We welcome people to call. Whether or not they are in distress or feeling suicidal. And one of the very first things I did in my new role was reach out to Marin Moms Demand Action. I think it's very critical, as we're talking about suicide from a public health perspective, that we begin to collaborate with stakeholders and organizations that have shared risk and protective factors so that we can begin to harness our resources and start applying harm reduction in communities where there's distress. About a day after we spoke, I was driving through San Anselmo and there was someone that had taken themselves hostage by gun. It's very important, again, that we start to examine suicide, not just why it's happening, but how it's happening. So it is a real honor to be here today, to have input into this dialogue, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Kara.
Good afternoon, everyone. And first of all, thank you to the congressman for the invitation today. My name is Alana Israel Samuels, and I work with Sandy Hook Promise, which of course was the organization that was founded immediately after the tragedy at Sandy Hook Elementary in December of 2012. So my role is the California region manager. And that means that I manage the programming that we bring directly to schools to prevent violence and all forms of victimization before it happens. And so the way that we do this is we have four Know the Signs programs. These are no cost to schools and school districts throughout the country because it has been a premise from the founding managing directors that money never get in the way of protecting a student from violence. And so those four programs, the first one is a student-facing program called Start with Hello. And Start with Hello is all about minimizing social isolation and creating environments at schools that are welcoming and that include everyone. Our next program, which is also student-facing, is called Say Something. Say Something is all about teaching students that they have to understand the signs, signals, and threats, especially in social media. And we know kids these days and students are on so many platforms that us adults can't even keep track of at this point. And so we want them to take those signs and signals seriously. We want them to act immediately and find a trusted adult and tell them so that the adult can then take action and do something and determine if it's a real threat or not of someone who might want to harm themselves or harm others. There's also something we have called the Anonymous Reporting System, which is an app, again, available at no cost to school districts that enables the students, instead of determining who's my trusted adult, they can actually use this anonymous app to submit a tip to, again, to get someone help. We're really clear with students that this is not about tattling or snitching. This is about helping somebody. Our next program is Signs of Suicide, which is actually a suicide prevention program. We partner with an organization called Screening for Mental Health to bring this program and this training to adults in school districts so that they can then turn around and directly train their students. And we actually recently in March had a countywide training in Marin that welcomed, I think it ended up being about 6 or 7 school districts or independent charter or private schools that came to that training that was sponsored by the Marin County Office of Education. And the whole goal of that is so that students and adults learn how to recognize the signs of someone who might want to harm themselves, or you can recognize that sign in yourself and get help. And then finally, our last program is completely adult-facing. It's called Safety Assessment and Intervention. It's a threat assessment model that's brought from Dr. Dewey Cornell out of the University of Virginia. And what's amazing about this program is it teaches school districts and teams at schools to recognize threats, understand those threats, and then get students the resources that they need to, again, meet our mission of preventing violence before it happens. So again, thank you for inviting us today. We're thrilled to be here, and I'm thrilled to especially hear from the students. Our students are the backbone of what we do. We have something called Save Promise Clubs, which stands for Students Against Violence Everywhere, and they are what makes us successful because those students carry our messages forward throughout their schools, and we're aiming at changing generations of students. So that becomes the culture of society moving forward. Thank you.
Terrific. Thank you. Well, thank you very much. Every one of the organizations that are represented here is doing fantastic, heroic work. But now we're going to hear from our student ambassadors, several of whom are back with us a second time. They were part of our summit last year. And here's how we'll do this. This is going to feel a little like speed dating. We're going to have to move fairly quickly. But I would like each of our student ambassadors to introduce themselves, tell us what school you're from, and also tell us if you're part of any special program on this issue. And once we move through that, we're going to dive into our questions.
Hi, I'm Isabel Williams. I'm a junior at TAM. Hi, and I'm the co-president of TAM Students Demand Action, and I work as a guest speaker at the Moms Demand Action Be Smart presentation around Marin.
Hello, I'm Allison. I'm a sophomore here at Dominican University, and I'm a member of our Associated Students of Dominican University.
Hi, my name is Lily Datnow. Thank you all for coming today. I am a junior at San Rafael High School, and I'm involved in this issue by working for some Common Sense gun violence candidates, so candidates who support that. I worked for Assemblymember Mark Levine. I was on Gavin Newsom's campaign for governor. I was the head intern for Anna Pletcher, and I applied to work for Jared Huffman. So we'll see about that.
We'd better look into that one.
I'm Amalia Boshin. I go to Drake. I'm a junior there. I've participated and spoken at gun violence walkouts, such as the one on the anniversary of the Columbine shooting. I also am the co-director of the SASH initiative, which works to end sexual violence, and I'm part of the SOAR anti-racism program at Drake, so a lot of my work with gun violence is through those lenses.
My name is Mirna Mejia Mungia. I am a senior at Terlinda High School. It's my second time around doing this panel, and I'm really excited. Since last year, I started a club called Terlinda Activism with my best friend, and we do a lot of work in the club surrounding a lot of social issues, and one of them including gun reform, which we organized a walkout for on the anniversary of Stoneman Douglas? Yeah, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, we did that. And I'm also part of MOR, which is Maroon Organizing for Racial Equity, which is a program for the Youth Leadership Institute that started this year, and we helped set that off, and I'm really happy to be here.
Hi, I'm Samantha. I'm a junior at Petaluma High School. Last summer, I went to a journalism camp at Stanford University, and got involved in a project with The Trace, which is an online publication that reports on gun violence, as well as the Miami Herald, where me and about 200 other journalists across the country, student journalists, wrote profiles to try to document the lives of every kid under the age of 18 and the age of 18 who has died due to gun violence in America since the Parkland shooting.
My name is Hannah Kahn. I'm a junior at TAM High, and I'm a co-president of the Students Demand Action Chapter with Isabel. And we've worked over the past year to organize vigils and walkouts for the different mass shootings that have happened.
Hi, I'm Jessica Brown. I go to Marin Academy. I'm a junior there, and I participated last year in the walkout that my school had in remembrance of the victims of the Parkland shooting, and I've participated in conversations around campus on the issue.
Hi, I'm Lindsay Dubin. I'm a junior at Radwood High School, and I'm in the Wellness Center Youth Council at my school. I also am the president of the Team Enough chapter in Marin, which is a branch of Brady campaign, but it's student-led. And then also I am the founder of Students for Safety, which is a club I created at my school.
Hi, my name is Elliot Scheuer. I'm a junior at Novato High School, and I'm the chair of the Health and Wellness Subcommittee for the Marin County Youth Commission. And I have also served on the steering committee for Peer Summit, which is a day-long conference for middle school students promoting wellness and general health.
Terrific. Thanks, everybody. All right, you now know a little bit about all of our participants. Let's dive into the discussion, and I'd like to get us started by exercising a bit of a moderator's prerogative. Mike Thompson's actually senior to me in the Congress, so he has that same prerogative anytime he wants in this dialogue. But I think I'll get us started by asking our student ambassadors something that probably many of us are wondering about, and that is what's going on with your campus culture on this issue? How are your peers responding to this increase in school shootings, and how are they feeling about it?
So I think the conversation has been opened up a bit more in light of all the mass shootings that have happened at school, and especially in light of the Parkland shooting. However, I really haven't noticed a change in administration at our school, like how they have been trying to create a safer environment at school. I had a club meeting last Friday and got a couple of quotes from some of the members regarding like the environment at school. So I will share one from my friend Gianna, who's a senior. And she was saying that, to quote her, "It scares me that it's become normal for me and my classmates to check our classrooms for the nearest exit or place to hide every time we are in school. And it scares me to know that millions of people are dying and politicians won't listen. And it scares me that I could be next." And I think just the general fear that happens going to school is very common among, I think, a lot of students at Redwood High School.
Novato High School, which is where I go, has really experienced a lot of the firsthand effects of inaction when it comes to mental health. We've had 3 suicides in the district within the last 2 years. And it's been really difficult to get the administration to pay attention because student wellness is not at the top of the list when the budget is tight. It's paying teachers and new buildings and fancy technology, but I think student wellness really gets lost, and that's when it starts to get dangerous because students are suffering and there's no one to listen to them.
I'd kind of like to speak to the part about the normalization that Lindsay spoke about, which is I think I have seen fear with a lot of my peers and my friends, especially over the past two years or so. But I think also having this issue be so prevalent and normalized in our society, I think kids tend to forget about it sometimes. And I've definitely seen, like especially in recent months, people don't take it as seriously anymore. It's just become such a normal part of life, which is terrible. But students aren't, I think, acting as much as they, like, things happen and people act for a month or so and they're very concerned, but then it just gets normalized and we're used to it.
I actually have not seen a lot of like conversation from my peers, but I have seen a lot of like worry from my teachers. It seems like every time something happens, my teachers are like, "Well, I remember growing up, this never happened." And so I think it's just confusing to a lot of people. And also I think it has been normalized to an extent because like I'm part of the school newspaper, and like whenever someone brings up an idea about covering a shooting or saying something about it, the editors are like, "Oh, we already did that last year." But it comes up so frequently, I think it needs to be talked about more.
By the way, as you're answering this question, you're welcome to tell us your thoughts about this proposal we keep hearing to arm teachers as the solution to this.
Well, I just want to speak, I wanted to say a couple anecdotes. I think echoing, there's a lot of worry from teachers, and because this is a real threat, and because, you know, I'm 17, I grew up with just this violence. It's normal to me, and it's normal to a lot of my peers. And I remember one day sitting in class, and my favorite teacher, this is a teacher who's provided me with a lot of guidance and comfort, stood up in front of the class and said, "If there was ever to be a school shooting, I would want you guys, you would go out the window, and I don't want you to wait for me. I will stand at the door and try to fight the shooter." And I can't even tell you, it's the tears coming to my eyes because it's a real threat. And the fact that my teacher would feel like he would need to give up our lives for our safety and arming teachers, it's adding to the problem. It's putting more guns out there, and I don't think that's the answer. And, you know, another story I have is my friend comes to me one day and she's and she's very nervous and on edge, and I'm asking her what's wrong, and she said, I was in, you know, our wellness center at school. You can get tea there during class or just come to chill. And she said someone came in there. He looked a little old to be a high schooler. And he started talking to me and saying, oh, when do you get out of class? Like, shouldn't you be in class now? Like, when do you have your classes? Like, asking about the schedule and stuff. And she said, I got really scared because I was wondering, like, who this person was and what he wanted to do. And I told her, I said, you have to go report that to the administration. That could be, a school shooter. And the fact that this is so normal is terrifying.
Yeah, I definitely think that it's become more common to talk about it among students. Last year, immediately after the Parkland shooting, I organized a walkout at my school, and there were a lot of students who were willing to step up and speak on the day of the event. Unfortunately, the day after we had the walkout, we also had a threat written on our bathroom wall. And you were saying how the school has changed and how it's affected that by that. I was never notified by the school. The way the word got out was that everybody started texting each other and everybody was saying, hey, if you have anybody's number who, share it with everyone. So I think every student in our school received a text from another student saying don't come today. And the school took no action to say whether that was confirmed or denied. So it was all word of mouth and it was really messy. And not that it's the school's responsibility to solve gun violence, but that was not the best way that could have been handled.
At Dominican, there's certainly conversations surrounding ways to make our campus safer. And one of the things I've really noticed is a lot of our conversations revolve around ways to make our environment safer. And that just shows how prevalent this issue has become, because we're an old campus. As you're here today, you probably noticed that. And so we've had people using these buildings for decades, and now we're noticing this isn't safe for students to be in. We need to make changes there. And it's something that's been in place forever, but now because of the climate we have, we need to make changes around that.
One thing that I've noticed at our school, Tam High, is that there's an insular culture around gun violence. A couple months ago, I was in a group of friends. One of my friends went on a tirade about how he would shoot up the school if he could, where he'd get the gun. Very specific details. I reported it to the administration. And afterward, I was ostracized, I was isolated, I lost friends because people treated me as if I was the one who had done something wrong. I was treated as if I should have known it was a joke, as if I'd ruined his life. And it was difficult, but it showed me that there is a real stigma around bringing this issue from a sphere of student conversation to a sphere of adult conversation. And there's a stigma around student reporting, which is unfortunate given that, in over 3/4 of, school shootings that were studied, somebody knew about it beforehand and didn't say anything. So I think it's important that we change the stigma and that we educate. At least we, our club is attempting to create a presentation to give to Marin County students about the issue and about how you can report if you or someone you know is struggling, wants to hurt themselves or others. I think it's incredibly important to educate students on just how life or death this matter is, because I think it's moved into a sphere of conversation that pushes adults out and pushes intervention out. And I think that's unfortunate, but I think there's a way to change that.
So thank you. Continuing on this subject of see something, say something, have any of you been in a home or a business where you saw a gun that you thought might not be properly secured? And if so, what did you do about it? Just wondering if any of you have encountered that. Maybe not. No? Okay.
Hi,
again. So I haven't had any personal experience with seeing a gun in a home or at a business or at school, of course. But what Mr. Porter was talking about was End Family Fire. And that's a really important initiative and program that started. And I think what their major proposals are is that you separate the bullets from the actual gun and make sure that it's safe and out of, locked up somewhere where a little kid or someone that's mentally unstable isn't going to go and get it. And I think that's something in Marin, I think a lot of the time we think, oh, we're safe here. There's no guns, but there's over 47,000 guns in our area. And so we need to really think about where we are storing our guns and if there are bullets in the guns and if they're ready to go. And just really ending awful things. I think two weeks ago, there was a four-year-old that was killed because they accidentally shot themselves. And these are innocent lives that are being taken, and it's preventable. So thank you.
Do you want to add anything?
Just if I could speak to both the issue of like having guns safely in a household and also arming teachers, I think there's a very real fear in our country of what happens if someone dangerous comes onto a school campus, into your home. How do you protect yourself and your loved ones? And I think that's where the idea of, I think people are scared if they separate their bullets, what happens if someone comes into their home? Are they going to be able to respond quickly enough? And, if teachers aren't armed, if someone comes into the classroom, how do they protect? But I think it's important that, like, the arming teachers idea, it's putting a Band-Aid on an issue that needs real resolution. You can't just give people more weapons and expect them to be able to protect themselves. You have to try and, like, you can't fight fire with fire. You have to be able to try and stop it, stop the root of the problem. And I think the guns in a home, I personally, like, haven't had any experience with it, but I think people, like I said, have this fear, and I think people need to be educated on how, if you're going to have a gun, how you can store it safely and use it safely and still protect yourself without shooting first and asking questions later.
I feel that the idea of arming teachers is very, like, almost like reverse logic, because the way that I see it, I work a lot with kids. I work at a daycare. And, like, our one of the routines that we have is that whenever we do staff training, we have these codes. And we have, like, a code blue, like, in case this happens, or a code pink in case this happens. And, like, one of the things that we are taught, like, from the very beginning is just, if there's a shooter, we need to ensure that the safety of the kids comes first. And I completely believe in that. If I had to put my lives down for this, for these kids that I have to take care of, I totally would. And the way that I see it, and I'm going to use an analogy with kids, is that you might have a group of kids, like, let's just say 20 kids. And if one of them grabs a really big stick and starts hitting the other kids with the stick, the solution is not to give the other 19 kids a stick. The solution is not to give the other 19 kids a stick and say, oh, well, if this kid has a stick, you need to protect yourself. Here's an even bigger stick. Go at it. You know, like, the solution would probably be, hey, you shouldn't have a stick in the first place. You take away the stick, and guess what? No kids hit each other with a stick anymore. And that's just the way that I see it. Like, you don't need to arm other people to be like, this is my own safety. Because even the security guards and teachers at Parkland, they were armed too. A lot of them were. And they didn't use them. And even if they did use them, what could that have done? Caused more death, caused more violence, caused more everything. And I don't feel like arming people as a defense for, like, oh, it's defense. I think it's very counterintuitive.
Well, I love the way you've gotten us into this talking point that we always hear from the gun lobby, which is the answer to all of these issues is always more guns. And, of course, they would tell us that this is about their Second Amendment rights. But they're getting into your rights, too, when they say the only answer to any of this is for you to have guns, for your parents and your teachers and everyone else to just be armed to the teeth. You also have some rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and that may not be the kind of world you want to live in. So tell us a little bit about how you feel in response to those who think that an ever more heavily armed society and education system is the way we're going to be safe.
My right to live overrides any other right that you think you may deserve. It just does. Like, you're not going to go up to children and the families of people who have lost children and the kids that are scared to go to school every single day because they're afraid of this issue. You're not going to go up to them and say, oh, you want to live? Okay, well, I want guns. It's like, there's no equivalent to that. Like, a person's life is more important than what you think you deserve to have a gun. And it's a law that was created hundreds of years ago that happened when the British were attacking and you could only load like 1 to 3 bullets at a time. Like you don't need to be having this huge magazine and like these huge bump stocks to like, there's nothing to justify someone living and breathing and feeling safe in their environment over you having a gun.
Amelia?
So I can speak a little bit to guns and homes. I have family who own guns, and I've known that for a while, at least in the case of one. On my mom's side, her great uncle loves to hunt. And he has, you know, we go to his house, and he has, you know, deers all over the wall, and he has these glass cases of guns, and they're there and they're in the hallway, and you know they're probably locked, I've never tried, but they're glass, and that's just, and he has young kids, and you know things can happen, and you know I haven't gone there in a while, and I was a kid when I first went there, but I distinctly remember feeling very uncomfortable and unsafe in that house and asking my mom about the guns and why do they have the guns. And I think you know, when we talk about, you know, family having guns, it's a touchy issue. And then my uncle, who I also love and care for, loves to shoot at the range. And, you know, that's something he does for fun. And they're a lot more secure than my great uncle's guns. They're in a, like, locked safe in the garage. But he has very young kids and has had those guns since they were very little. And I love those kids with everything I have, and I don't like that they're living in a house with guns. I don't like it. And speaking on what I've done, I mean, I think, you know, the son that he has wanted this like Nerf gun for Christmas, and I remember looking at that and being like, Mom, I don't think we should get that for him. Like, it looks like a gun. Like, even though it's like painted in like yellow and green, it looks, you know, like a gun. It's modeled to look like a gun. And, you know, I think, and, you know, obviously echoing what she said on arming teachers, no, we can't do that because it's giving people more guns and it's giving more fire to the issue and giving the NRA more money. So
let's pause there for a second. We've got some questions from the audience, so we'll quickly take those and then get back to our student ambassadors. By the way, if the students want to ask any questions of us, either Mike and myself or any of our panelists, just put your hand up or grab a microphone and chime on in. But we have a few quick questions from the audience. One is about following New Zealand's action after their recent sad mass shooting. Within 2 weeks, they had a new law banning assault weapons. Another one is what's being done to address transparency of NRA and lobbying activities. And then another one is, what's the status of bump stock legislation? So, Mike, you probably know the status of bump stock legislation. I know there was a regulation or a standard passed by the Trump administration that was challenged in court, but where does that stand?
Well, there is legislation. As you know, the bump stock issue became public after the terrible tragedy in Las Vegas. And before that, many people had no idea what a bump stock was or what it did. And if any of you fall into that category, it's an aftermarket device you can attach to a semi-automatic weapon, and with it, that semi-automatic weapon fires as though it were fully automatic. And the Obama administration tried to regulatorily prohibit them, and were told right away that it couldn't be done regulatorily, that it needed to be done legislatively. There was bipartisan legislation introduced in Congress right away. Again, it got no hearing, it got no votes. The new president came in, and he administratively took an action to prohibit bump stocks, and it is being challenged. So if the Bureau of Alcohol, Firearms, and Tobacco is correct, that will be overruled. Notwithstanding the challenge, the administrative action, or where it goes from here, there should be legislation passed, signed into law, that prohibits the bump stocks, because as I say, it makes an otherwise legal weapon into makes it function as though it would be an illegal weapon.
On the issue of transparency for lobbying activity and dark money, one of the bills Mike and I have had a chance to pass out of the House, H.R. 1, would provide a lot of relief to these kind of shenanigans. So I think that responds to the other question. And then finally, the question about New Zealand. Let me just say, and Mike, chime in, please. I was envious of New Zealand in the aftermath of their terrible mass shooting, because what we saw was a leader who had the empathy and the compassion and the decency to actually console her nation properly and the victims properly after this tragedy, and then turn around and take action. Both of those things are sorely missing right now in the White House in this country, but it's a standard we should keep in our minds as we go forward, because wouldn't it be great for this country to have that same style and action-oriented leadership?
Well, I'll just add that there's one very significant difference between the United States of America and New Zealand, and that has been talked about already today, and that's the Second Amendment. The Second Amendment gives individuals a right to own firearms. It doesn't give them a right to own 22s or shotguns or assault weapons or musket. It gives them the right to own a firearm. So it would be impossible for the United States to take an action as swiftly as New Zealand took their action. But what I think happens is, I think it sends a message to the American people. This is what New Zealand did. The United States is doing nothing, nor has it done anything in years. And I think that that helps build the momentum to put the political pressure on Congress, on the presidency, to do whatever is necessary to keep our communities safe. Start by passing the background check legislation. But we have not, in Congress, as I said, in 26 years, done anything. And in the last 6.5 years, while Jared and I were working on expanding background checks, the then majority took action on two pieces of gun legislation. One was a bill to allow more people to carry a concealed weapon. What the bill was called, concealed carry reciprocity. And what it would have done is, it would have said, if you have a concealed carry permit issued by any state in the United States, you can carry that weapon in any other state. Now, just know, some states have no standard. In some states, all you have to have in order to carry a concealed weapon is a concealable weapon. So if someone in Marin County can't get a license to carry a concealed weapon because of, you fill in the blank, is it right that that person can, over the telephone, call the Department of Agriculture in Florida, pay $25, and get a Florida concealed carry permit and carry it in Marin County? It's absolutely ridiculous. The other bill that they took up, and if this wasn't so tragic, it would really be funny. They introduced legislation called the Hearing Protection Act of 2018. And what that bill would have done is it would have legalized the over-the-counter sale of silencers. Now, understand that unlike the movies that I'm sure we've all seen, if you put a silencer on a firearm and you shoot it, it doesn't make it whisper. It lowers the sound a little bit, but it distributes the sound dispenses it over a greater area, making it harder to identify where the sound is coming from. So if you have an active shooter situation and the police respond and they don't know where the shots are coming from, before they figure it out, how many more people are going to die? So there's a real difference in values, and there's a real difference in philosophy on this issue amongst our different members of Congress. And elections have consequences, and we saw that. In the last election, the majority changed. We started passing legislation to make our communities safer.
Thank you, Mike. Do any of our panelists have a question for our student ambassadors? Our student ambassadors have a question for us. All right, let's do it.
So on Friday, President Trump was at an NRA meeting, and he announced that the U.S. will be withdrawing from the arms trade treaty. And I was wondering kind of what that means for accessibility of guns.
It's just ridiculous. you know, I don't know how else to explain it, but it is absolutely ridiculous. It is going to do nothing to help anyone. If you'll excuse the pun, a shot across the bow. He wants to, if it were up to him, he would repeal anything the last president did, anything the last president's administration did. This is not something that's going to make our communities safer. It's not something that's going to be better for business. And it's not something that really affects the people of the United States of America. What it does is it makes other parts of the world more unsafe, and he should be ashamed of himself.
Me? Oh, you going?
Go ahead,
Lily. Okay. Hi. So I think something that a lot of students have felt, I don't want to speak for you guys, but I know that people I've talked to have, that we've gone to a lot of marches and different speeches and rallies, and we feel like a lot of it is up to leadership, the, you know, people we elect to represent us like you, and I'm hearing you guys kind of say the same thing, but about the higher ups, and I know that that is hard with the current administration, but I guess the question is, like, what is the plan moving forward? Because if we're hearing our representatives having the same frustrations that we're having, then, you know, how can we have faith that there's going to be something better in the future?
It's a great question. And I think this sort of gets into the current state of gun politics in the United States Congress and in the country more broadly. I will tell you, I think we're making significant progress. And I think one reason for that progress is your generation and these young people that came together so bravely and effectively after, especially after the Parkland, Florida shooting. We have had those student ambassadors in to speak with our caucus in Washington. They have made the rounds, and we will have them, I'm sure, testifying in hearings for the first time in many years. We also have a new colleague from Georgia who won a seat that was not supposed to have flipped to a Democrat. Her name is Lucy McBath, and she is the mom of a gun violence victim. So she is herself a gun violence victim. But she is one of many new members of Congress that spring in a fresh perspective and a passion, invigorated by the leadership we see from your generation. So I see a major change. Now, how much we can translate that into action remains to be seen, but I think we're making progress.
I agree with that completely, but let me just add one thing. Going back to the tragedy at Parkland, we saw student involvement at a level we've never seen before. maybe equal to the protest against the Vietnam War, maybe equal to the voting rights movement. But we saw kids across the country really become engaged. As I mentioned, 60% of high school students are afraid that there's going to be a shooting at their school. Junior high school students feel threatened by this as well. But in Florida, a couple of things happened. A Florida state legislature that has never been inclined to pass gun safety laws passed a law right away after Parkland. And it wasn't a lot, but it was something. And then something that just was mind-boggling happened. A governor that, if you'll excuse the analogy, wouldn't sign a gun violence prevention bill if you held a gun to his head, signed it darn near before the ink was dry. Now, the fact that there were 300,000 17-year-olds in Florida who were going to be eligible to vote in that election, I believe, had something to do with it. In the midterm elections, every seat that we flipped, we the Democrats flipped, gun violence prevention was part of that Democrats' platform. As someone once said, and I'm sure Jarrett could sing it for us if he had his guitar, the times, they are changing.
Come, senators, congressmen, please heed the call. No, we won't sing.
I know that all of us probably want to continue working on this issue and being helpful to the movement. So I have a question for the panelists. I was wondering, what in your experience has been, where have student activists and student voices been very effective in creating change and starting a conversation? How can we be successful in adding our voices to a cause and actually having a concrete result?
For the advocates.
Yeah, so from the perspective of Sandy Hook Promise, it really has already started with all of you, and I know sometimes that it feels a little bit powerless, especially when you're not old enough to vote yet. And, you know, I think that having a club, being involved in something at your school, like you mentioned already, where you're trying to change the culture so that it becomes a space where someone is looked at funny when they don't say something, rather than looked at funny because and marginalized because they did. And so I think it's continuing to build on that and to think about how that can be perpetuated on an ongoing basis to make sure that you leave a legacy at your high school, right? So there's someone to continuing involving those younger students, perhaps getting out into your middle schools. That's what we advocate with our organization, is starting those Save Promise clubs or bringing the messages from the clubs into already existing clubs. So it starts earlier so that the momentum builds. And then I encourage you, I know there's a couple of seniors in the rows, to become part of this effort, like you are at Dominican, at whatever, you know, your next step is in higher education as well, and to continue it and vote.
I'm gonna talk real quick, just because, like, I thought that the question was like a really good question to answer. I feel that a lot of times the youth is kind of presented in a way that it's like, oh, well, they're just kids. It's like, oh, like, why, like, we're often asked to, like, act more grown up, but then when we start talking about issues that have to do with stuff that really relates to us, such as, like, gun violence or, like, sexism or a ton of other things, it's like, oh, well, why are you talking about that? You're just a kid. And, yeah, we might just be kids, but I also feel like that's the point. And I feel like a big part of possibly almost trying to get more, like, of a rise out of our voices could be to consult those generations before us that did have these huge movements, that did have, like, the protests for the Vietnam War, that did have the civil rights movement, and consult them, like, how did you do this? How did you manage to get your voice to be heard that much? What did you do and what strategies did you use in order to be heard? And I feel like since they have the experience that we possibly lack, or they can have the information that we possibly lack too. And I feel like looking up to them and their movements and what they did and their strategies could be a really big part of getting our voices together and making it more powerful.
I would point out two things. One, you have superpowers. Your first superpower is you're a massive demographic. That matters to people that are running to represent us. And certainly you can use that directly. They get it, just as the congressman was saying, they get it very quickly. The second thing is, and this is your real superpower that I can't even imagine to understand, is using social media. How this movement will operate relative to the civil rights movements or some of these other movements in the past, there will be similarities, but there's going to be a huge difference, and that huge difference is social media. And your ability to organize, to spread words, to make heroes out of people, to make villains out of people, to do it quickly and effectively is unparalleled. And I would keep that in mind as you go forward wanting to be active. Use that superpower.
Thank you. I would just add that in the earlier, one of you had asked a question about how, you know, to get the conversation going, and probably one potential avenue for increasing the dialogue is to frame this conversation in part via a public health perspective. And if we can start as a society, start looking at loss of productivity, the financial impact, the social impact, I think we can start having more impact in educating people about what we need to do from a public health standpoint. We know that a recent study was just conducted that indicated that those states that have the highest percentage of households of gun owners have the highest percentage of teen suicides. So if we can start having these kind of conversations, we can start to evaluate the impact of guns on self-injury and harm to others. And obviously, accessibility to guns means there's a greater risk for a teen dying via suicide.
I would just like to add, what's truly remarkable about these kids is not only the numbers, but they know what they're talking about. They know that research into gun violence prevention has been all but hobbled. They know that the system for recording data on guns is completely archaic. They know that toy guns are more regulated than real guns. They know their stuff. They're not just showing up saying, I want to live. You know, they're researching, they're understanding. And they're saying to their parents, you know, stop with the organic food. This is the second leading cause of death. Do something. So by speaking truth to power, they're being incredibly effective. So just keep it up.
I just want to say two things. First of all, something that you said. My history teacher has talked a lot about people saying that, like how it annoys her when people say teenagers aren't mature enough or don't know enough about something to like have an impact on it. But she told me a story that like really proves that that's false, and that basically people who already have the right to vote can also be immature or ignorant. Because like she told me that, I don't know if it was in a video she saw or like she witnessed it herself, but there were like some people going around asking people to sign a petition for women's suffrage. And people were like, oh, so women are suffering now? Well, we wanna help them. And so like people don't always know what's going on. So first, I think an important thing to have an impact is to educate yourself and help educate other people. And then also just like take any opportunity you can. When I got involved in the project Since Parkland, where I the thing I described, I was at Stanford University, and the person in the CEO of The Trace, which started the project, came to talk to us at the camp. And I almost didn't go because I was like afraid that like I wouldn't be good at it, or I wouldn't have like done justice to the children who had died. But then I texted the director of the camp and I said, hey, I'm sorry I didn't make the meetings today. I really want to do this now. So like, I guess just don't be afraid and take every opportunity you possibly can is the best way to have an impact.
So go ahead. A question that's just come in from the audience. We alluded to it a moment ago, but the question is, what is the status of research into the gun violence issue? So I'm going to hand it over to the Gun Violence Encyclopedia, Mike Thompson, to tell us the latest on that.
Well, thank you. Everybody probably knows that research on gun violence was stifled a number of years ago in Congress by a bill passed by Jay Dickey, a former member of Congress from Arkansas. And I knew Jay when he was in the House. And when I got involved in this, I called him. He had since retired. And he said, you know, he said, I know everybody points to that bill, but no one's ever asked, you're the first person that's ever asked me. He said, it was not my intent to stifle research on gun violence. He said, all I wanted to do with that bill was to ensure that research wasn't done to outlaw guns. And I said, well, you know, it'd be really helpful if you would clarify that. And I said, I think I might be able to do something with a letter if you were to draft it, which he did. And he laid it out clearly. And we have used that. But again, for 6.5 years, we didn't have a receptive leadership. Now we do. And there's a number of bills that have been introduced to resolve this issue. And there's some action taking place in the appropriations process to provide more funding and clear the debris that has been blocking funding on gun violence prevention legislation. So that's changing.
Question from our advocates or our students? Yeah.
So I wanted to ask that given the political climate, it seems kind of unlikely that a piece of comprehensive gun reform will pass through all bodies of legislative office and come to actually into action. So I was wondering kind of what you think can and should be done now by, I guess, people in general to protect the safety of people and students especially.
Well, I'll throw out a couple of things. I'm sure the others may want to add to it. But look, I feel like the political times are a change, and as Mike referenced, these groups and other groups like them, Gabby Giffords has a group with a political action arm to it, are at the point now when you add up their membership, it's bigger than the NRA. And that's a tipping point. That is a significant tipping point, and you've already seen it begin to influence elections. And it's part of the reason why we have this Democratic majority in the House right now. I think it's going to be a big part of the 2020 Senate election and maybe even the presidential election. And so don't assume that our ability to change the politics to where we can do a lot more on this issue is some very distant situation. I think it may be closer than you think. And then in the meantime, I would just say get ready. I don't know if you all are old enough to vote or if you're registered to vote, but one of the things we did, again, in this great reform bill, H.R. 1, that we passed out of the House, was make it possible for 16-year-olds to pre-register so that the moment you turn 18, you're automatically a voter. You don't have to do anything more. And while we wait for that ultimate tipping point at the national level, there's opportunities to continue making progress in state and local government. So those are just a few of my thoughts. And Mike or others, you want to add anything to that?
I just want to say that little actions add up, you know, texting and phone banking and writing letters and all of that good stuff, it works. So any little thing that you can do to add your voice to the cause is going to have an impact when it's multiplied by zillions of people. And we have zillions of people now, so do your part.
Let me just add one thought. I was going to mention it earlier in the previous question, but if I were back in high school, there's a lot of things I'd do differently, but I think it would be a real good exercise for high school students who live in districts where they're represented by people like Jared, myself, who are already on board on this, to try and work with peers in other high schools where their member of Congress isn't. So in California, we did not get one Republican member of Congress to vote for expanding the background checks. Now, you already heard how popular this is. 97%. Who said 97%? Yeah. I was told by the pollsters, don't say how popular this is, because if people hear you say 97%, they won't believe you. Just say over 90%. But absolutely correct. 97% of the American people believe we should expand background checks. So if I were a high school student, I'd figure out how to create partnerships with my peers in high schools where their member of Congress isn't with us, and get them, help them organize, help them do what you're doing here to influence their member of Congress. Because we got this bill out of the House. It's over in the Senate now. Mitch McConnell doesn't yet know that he needs to take this up. But with the help of you and your peers, he'll get the message.
I have a quick question for the congressman, actually. Okay. Advice for the students that I think will be helpful, because they'll all within the next few years be heading on to something else in higher education. And I know it came up for my own kids. Is it better or make more sense for them to stay registered locally, even if they're, you know, going to college in LA and vote by mail, or does it make more sense? Because I know it's a problem with college students not voting, right? That takes more effort.
Right. Well, let's be very strategic about that question, okay? it may depend where you go to school. Okay? If you're going to go to school in Boston, where every member of Congress votes and looks just like us, it may not make much difference, mm-hmm. right? But if you're going to go to Tulane or somewhere in the South or the Midwest, mm-hmm. you should think about registering at school where you can actually make a difference, right? I'm just being very strategic about it.
But let me make one thing real clear. In another life, I taught at Cal State Chico, and the Chico community was, Chico. the Harvard of the CSU system. But the community was always being criticized that Chico State students were tilting the elections, that these out-of-towners were coming up here and they were voting to influence the election. And one of my colleagues in the political science department did a research project on this and found out that in Chico, students didn't vote. So don't fall into that, don't go someplace, register to vote there, and then be home on break during election and not vote. Wherever you decide you're gonna vote, vote.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have a question. So I think when we talk about gun violence, right, I can speak to this, I think as a white woman and living in my school is in San Anselmo, which data came out that it's 89.7% white. So my threat of gun violence has only come up in the last few years, but I think when we talk about gun violence, especially police violence with guns, which I know is a very touchy subject, people of color live in a very different reality than I do. And I was wondering if anyone can speak to action that's been being taken on police brutality. I'm 172 people.
Use of force policies?
Yeah, I mean, 172 people were killed in California by police alone in 2017. And three-quarters of the people who were unarmed were people of color, and two-thirds of the people killed overall were people of color. There's clearly a problem here. So.
Well, thank you for that question. Thank you very much for that question, because when you do see excessive force and some of these terrible incidents that we now, by virtue of cell phones, have a chance to see for ourselves with our own eyes, that's gun violence too. And we have to make sure that we're holding folks accountable for that. One of the easy parts to answering that question, I believe, is the deployment of body cams everywhere, because it will not only keep hopefully incidents like that from happening, or we'll have fewer of them. It just keeps everybody on better behavior. I've talked to police officers throughout my district, and almost every sheriff and local police department is in the process of or has already deployed these things. And what they're finding is that even the people they pull over that are not going to be, everyone's just on much better behavior with that camera rolling. Other thoughts about this? Okay. Well, good. Well, we've had a fantastic discussion. Let me just see if there's anyone who's been dying to jump in and hasn't had the chance to do that. Want to make sure we're not. He's trying to get it. Any one of our student ambassadors or panelists trying to jump in and haven't had a chance?
So I feel like to go back to Amalia's question or like statement about the whole like people of color and the gun violence thing. I feel like a lot of it also kind of relates to the whole like mental health aspect of it, but in a way that's kind of a little skewed. Whereas if it's a common trend that I've seen that if it's a white shooter, it's kind of categorized as a like, oh, like this is mentally challenged lone wolf kind of situation. That's exactly what happened in Parkland. That's how they labeled that shooter. And I read a story the other day that there was a black man that had heard his neighbor crying and screaming, and it was a 7-year-old girl. And he went into her house and he found that there was a man trying to rape her. So he shot the rapist. But all the news stories had it labeled as like, oh, the shooter of this, or like the thug that did this. And it's like, there's obviously some kind of way that the conversation is skewed to kind of make it seem like we're targets. And like, I don't want to kind of like tilt the conversation towards that, but it's definitely a factor that comes up when you talk about gun violence for sure.
It absolutely is. And I'm glad you reminded us of this. Intrinsic bias is part of this conversation. So my colleague, Mike Thompson, tells me there's a guy in like the fourth row that's been dying to ask a question. So let's do it. Why don't you just shout it out and I'll repeat it? No? All right, we're going to.
Hi, this is easier, I think, with your permission. Thought, I call this thoughts while shaving. And here goes. Here's a thought. In the mornings, I live in Terralinda. There are schools and there are volunteers. They've got a pink or red thing on and a stop sign, and they make sure that the little kids or the parents with the kids, that the traffic stops just to protect kids. And you were asking, I think I remember you saying, well, what can we do to do that? All right. I go down in Larkspur, give you another idea. In Greenbrae, excuse me, Bank of America. Not everywhere in Bank of America, there's a guard standing there with a gun. They're protecting the money more than the kids. These are my thoughts. Here's another thought. I traveled, I'm an American now, but I was born in Israel, and I travel there often. When you go to, and I'll just give you an example, a Macy's or Nordstrom's, there's somebody standing there, and you have to open up your bag to show that you don't have a weapon in it. It's not perfect, but it's a bit of a deterrent. So I'm just saying, as I heard and I read, that different governments or cities hired ex-Israelis to come over and to teach.
Security consultants.
Exactly, yeah. Because yeah. Necessity is the mother of invention. Yeah. And if we are a little bit behind, then let's take information from countries that had to live with horrible incidents.
I appreciate. Those are good thoughts. Let me ask our students, are there things that you have noticed in your schools or things that you would like to see in your schools that aren't being done to just make it a little bit safer with some of these strategies?
Well, I can speak to having guards on campus. We have two school resource officers, which are fully uniformed and completely armed police officers on campus at all times. And I can say without a doubt, it does not make me feel any safer to have a man with a gun on campus. It absolutely, even though he's not there to he's not even there to protect us in case of an emergency like that. He's there for students who are on probation or violating parole, but the fact that he has a gun makes me feel less safe because he walks into classrooms and it's right there and a student could grab it, he could drop it, I don't know. But it certainly doesn't make me feel any better to have someone with a gun on campus even though they're trained to use it.
So some of the students and I were just talking backstage before we started this conversation out here. And one of the things I heard students say is that they are having to pay now to print paper at their school because the schools are so overburdened with so many different issues and so underfunded that they cannot even like provide those students with paper. So I feel like while the schools do have a responsibility to keep those students safe, it's kind of unfair and unrealistic to expect schools to solve that issue. So I think that us having this conversation with legislators and outside programs is going to be much more effective. I mean, if the schools can help, that's great, but I don't think that the schools are going to be the solution.
There was a study done a little while ago about armed intervention in shootings, people who used weapons that they had on them to attempt to stop a shooting versus people who were not armed but still attempted to intervene, and it was found that the people who were not armed were actually more successful at stopping acts of gun violence than the people who were armed. There's another study, I can't remember the exact figure, but it was an alarmingly low percentage of times in which police fire has successfully stopped or intervened in a shooting. So I agree with Elliot in that armed resource officers don't make me feel safer just because of the statistics that we have to back up the fact that, you know, more guns and more people with guns don't necessarily make us safer. That's an NRA argument. And I think the NRA has lost a lot of credibility with the recent New Yorker Trace investigation that exposed a lot of the financial shadiness that's been going on. And yeah, also with David Hogg did a live stream the other day, and he was talking about how the NRA gets more of its funding from gun manufacturers than from its members. So the argument that more guns will make us safer, considering the source, is an economic argument. It's
You've
not a political argument.
You've been doing your homework argument on the NRA. And, you know, when Oliver North quits your organization over ethical problems, you might have trouble. Folks,
I just want to add one quick thing.
Okay, let's do that, and then we're going to
regarding adding more guns to any situation. When it comes to children, the mere presence of a gun is a higher risk factor than a prior mental illness.
Wow.
Relating to suicide.
And that's just data. All right, we have one final question. It's what can we do as the public to ensure that politicians listen to us on these issues and do what we want? This is a great closing question, I think, and we don't have time for every single person to speak to it, but if there are a couple of good ideas in response to this question, it seems like a good way to close out. Well, there's that, yeah. Vote him out. Go ahead.
Well, I think that Congressman Thompson made a really astute point earlier about the Second Amendment and about how it's going to be very difficult in the U.S. to get anything passed that's going to get rid of guns. And so, personally, I think as American citizens, for everyone, what our priority should be about now is about education. You know, and you should just be doing your best. Like, don't stay quiet. Do your research and, like, just keep talking about it. Get the word out. Even because I think if you look at any movement that's happened throughout American history, it starts small and it feels small and it feels like baby steps, but that's how big action happens.
and you do it by word of mouth, or now we have social media like you guys were talking about earlier, like we have these great resources to just, you know, you do your research, you get it out there, you tell your peers, you tell adults, you post something on Facebook or Instagram or whatever it is, and you just make sure that you don't stay quiet and that you get heard. And I think that's like the most powerful form of change we have.
And you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. You need to stand up, you need to sound off, you need to get involved, you need to get your friends involved. But just one thing about the Second Amendment. In 2008, when the Supreme Court opined on the Heller decision, Heller versus the District of Columbia, they were very, very specific. They said, yes, the Second Amendment is clear. Individuals have a right to own firearms. But they also opined that the government has a right and a responsibility to regulate those firearms.
And that was a 5-4 decision, by the way. So it was closer than you think. Somebody should have probably said in response to this last question, you can join one of these fantastic organizations that we see represented here. Every one of them is building this constituency for common sense gun policies. Oh, here it is. Mike is shamelessly promoting his bike ride fundraiser called Rock the Ride.
It's not my fundraiser. It's a bicycle ride. It's called Rock the Ride Napa. You can go online. It's the 29th of June. It is going to be a fabulous afternoon and morning in Yountville up in the Napa Valley. It came about last year. We had three wonderful young women who were healthcare providers to the Veterans Home in Yountville who were murdered. And a group of us came together and we set up this ride. It's everybody here can do something there. There's a 25-mile bike ride. There's a 10-mile bike ride. There's a 1-mile walk. There's a silent auction. So if you can't walk or ride, you can bid. And when we get done with the ride and the walk part, there's going to be an incredible lunch called Burritos and Bubbles. Get a team to come ride. Get a team to come walk. Come up and hang out for the morning. It's going to be a lot of fun. 29th of June, Rock the Ride Napa.
And I just want to add, in terms of joining these groups, doing the ride that you talked about, again, I'm just going to always speak from a public health standpoint. On May 2nd, the county leaders are coming together to unveil the early phase of the strategic plan around suicide prevention in Marin County. 74% of suicides in Marin County are by men and boys. We need every stakeholder with shared risk and protective factors to attend this meeting May 2nd at 5:30.
Terrific. Folks, please join me in thanking our student ambassadors. Please thank our terrific advocates. And our special guest, Congressman Mike Thompson. Thank you for a great conversation.